Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. For all your gold and silver coin needs, our guest tonight is James Corbett of the Corbett Report. You can find it at CorbettReport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. James has been working and living in Japan since 2004. Started the Corbett Report in 2007 as an outlet for independent and critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. I was joking with James last week when he was on here, and I was wondering if I'm going to run out of questions before he runs out of answers. James has a great breadth of knowledge. He's also editorial writer for the International Forecaster, a weekly e-newsletter created by the recently deceased economic analyst Bob Chapman. Hello, James. How are you doing?
Not too bad, Alfred. How about yourself?
Good, good. Glad to have you here again. Good to talk to you. Let's go through a little of the news. Here's something from the New York Times. Ebola cases could reach 1.4 million within 4 months, CDC estimates. Yet another set of ominous predictions about the Ebola epidemic in West Africa was released Tuesday in a report from the Center of Disease Control and Prevention that gave worst case and best case estimates for Liberia, Sierra Leone based on computer modeling. Worst case, two countries could have a total of 21,000 cases of Ebola by September 30th and 1.4 million cases by January 20th. If the disease keeps spreading without effective methods to control it. What do you think about Ebola? I mean, this is an odd situation because Ebola's been around. It was first identified back about 1989, if I understand correctly. So it's been here 25 years. And we've had a little problem with it that we're aware of. But now all of a sudden, there are reports that this thing might be extraordinarily contagious. Are these reports exaggerated? What's happened, if they're not, what's happened to Ebola to change it from a problem to a catastrophe over the course of the last 25 years? Do you have any idea?
Well, that is an important question to examine, and it actually extends back even further. I believe it was first identified in the mid-1970s, the first outbreak coming in 1976 in Zaire. And it's interesting the fact that there has never been an outbreak in the west part of Africa before where it is currently spreading. So there is some question to this that remains as to exactly how this current epidemic started or why it was suddenly we're suddenly seeing it in a different part of the continent that it's never been on before. And there are some very intriguing parts of the story that line up in a way that suggests that this has something to do with some vaccination campaigns that were going on in West Africa at the beginning of the year and the late part of last year, connected to some research that was being done under the auspices of programs that were funded in part by DARPA and some of the other U.S. governmental agencies that were involved in funding that research. Some very interesting implications there, but the long story short is that certainly this does have the potential to continue to be an epidemic of great concern to people in these countries, but it's not simply, as with all of these types of health outbreaks, it's not simply the health concerns that I think that the immediate health concerns of contracting the disease that people have to worry about so much as the types of things that happen as a result of the general hysteria and panic that these events cause and ultimately propagate. And one example of that are the kinds of things that we see happening in places like Sierra Leone right now, where there are house-to-house searches being undertaken right now that have apparently turned up 358 new cases, but it's still a pretty nightmarish situation to think if this was on the streets of the United States, for example, and they were coming door to door to check, you know, who is sick and to cart people away to some type of FEMA camp if they were determined to be so. I mean, one could imagine the level of violation of basic civil liberties that that is taken for granted during times like this. So it's a very worrying time for a lot of reasons. And unfortunately, I think the only people who are making hay from it are the manufacturers of the various would-be treatments for Ebola itself.
The thing that's disturbing about this, well, first off, you are implying that there are at least interesting conspiracy theories as to how did this get started in Sierra Leone, for example. How did the disease get here? And why is it so much more contagious? If the CDC is correct, if their computer estimate turns out to be anywhere near correct, and it could reach 1.4 million victims by January 20th of next year, we're talking a rate of contagion that can't possibly be contained and won't be contained on the shores of Africa. I guarantee if you've got a disease, I think this is exaggerated. I certainly hope this is exaggerated. But if you've got a disease that can go from essentially zero to 1.4 million whose lives are threatened within a matter of 4 or 5 months, how can you keep that disease from spreading to Europe and to the United States and to Japan? Do you have any idea?
Well, I mean, if we're looking at that growth trajectory, I think it would obviously be impossible almost to keep it contained unless, of course, you start with the physical isolation of the countries involved, which is an enormous undertaking. And in fact, something that would only be possible through the invocation of special emergency measures that were, in fact, invoked by the WHO earlier on in this Ebola crisis. This is something that I went into on my episode on the Ebola outbreak, episode 293 of my podcast, which is up on CorbettReport.com if people are interested in going and checking that out, where I talked about there's a special type of status that the World Health Organization was able to invoke as a result of the panic that was happening at the time. I believe it was in August that this was declared. It might have even been earlier than that. But the WHO declared something called a public health emergency of international concern, which is an obscure part of something called the international health regulations that now I believe 193 countries and states have signed up to. And basically what this does is that it allows the WHO to implement all sorts of extraordinary measures to try to contain the outbreak in whatever way they see fit, including and up to the point of actually shutting down travel to certain regions or countries. And of course, the WHO has absolutely no way of affecting this. How on earth would they be able to do that? And the answer came in an article from Newsweek that involved the director of the Global Health Policy Center at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, which is a globalist-connected think tank. And he was at that time talking about how NATO is great at this type of thing. They have military assets and they have experience deploying them in and out of countries anywhere in the world. They would be great for, you know, locking down a country or doing whatever was necessary under this legislation. So the legislative framework is already in place, and WHO already has the power to implement a lot of these measures. They just have to pull the trigger, so to speak, on those powers to put them into effect. And it's really just a question of how they get implemented. And this is all part of the precedent establishment phase of this Ebola event, which I think with every passing epidemic, we see the types of basically precedents that are being set for some pretty remarkable things that would have been unthinkable in any other circumstance are made to seem not only thinkable, but well, why aren't we doing it?
Necessary.
Yet? Yeah.
Do you think they can succeed again if the contagion rate is as great as these numbers imply? Do you think any effort to confine this disease is likely to work at this time?
Well, let me put it this way. I am exceptionally skeptical of those CDC numbers, and for a number of reasons. First of all, as It was an interesting little sidebar in an article I was reading, and I'll have to dig up the reference. I believe it was NBC News, but it was a pretty mainstream article about the Ebola outbreak that just happened to note that of all of the patients that have traveled away from West Africa and to a developed country to seek treatment, like the American patients, etc., all of them have managed to recover quite easily from the illness, given nothing more than nursing care and proper nutrition. And it seems to me that there is probably a common underlying factor regarding the kind of horrible results that we see sweeping West Africa with regards to just basic nutrition and basic access to clean and safe sort of place to rest and recuperate. So I'm not sure if the disease itself is as ravaging as it is being portrayed, if we take the proper context into account. So what it looks like as it's traveling through West Africa is not necessarily at all what it would look like if it were to be traveling through the United States. The other thing...
That's a good thing. I mean, that's good to hear. I'm sure people are relieved a little bit, but I've seen reports that the government has allegedly ordered something like 170,000 hazmat suits in anticipation of dealing with Ebola, perhaps in this country.
Absolutely, and they've also ordered millions of rounds of hollow point ammunition. They've ordered...
For dealing with people.
Exactly. Well,
they got 170,000 hazmat suits to deal with those of us who get Ebola, and bullets for those of us who don't.
Yeah. Well, that's a horrible way of looking at it. But I think that the underlying point of this is that the government stockpiles a lot of things for the benefit of their crony-connected corporate friends. And I think this ties directly into this idea, because back in 2009, let's not forget the swine flu scare, which scared up billions upon billions upon billions of dollars for the vaccine manufacturers, in the service of trying to alleviate an epidemic that ultimately ended up killing less people than the average flu. It was in fact a remarkably underwhelming season in terms of flu deaths back in 2009, and yet we had this global panic going on that necessitated country after country buying billions upon billions upon billions of dollars of vaccines. And after that was investigated, even the Council of Europe, which launched its own investigation, came to the conclusion that the WHO, that members of the board that declared pandemic in the 2009 emergency were connected to the vaccine manufacturers who ended up benefiting from it. So there is a direct economic stake in these types of decisions that I don't think we should just dismiss. I mean, I think this still remains. Obviously, the pharmaceutical industry has stands to benefit from this in all sorts of ways. And this is why we've seen, for example, all of these types of ZMAP and these other supposed miracle cures for Ebola suddenly getting millions and billions of dollars to start their human trials and testing and to get the green light to go ahead. And the attendant companies that own these various miracle cures are now booming in the stock market. So there are economic considerations here that I don't think are incidental to this. I think they're kind of baked into the cake when we start looking at these epidemic scenarios.
In other words, again, this is more evidence that this is more likely to be hyped than it is an accurate report of what the danger, what the level of danger may be.
I personally am not scared of it at this moment. We'll put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you think this has, and I've got a report here from ZeroHedge.com, CNBC viewership plunges to 21-year lows. And they're simply saying, listen, people have stopped paying attention to CNBC. Does this mean that people are getting smarter? Does it mean they're less trusting of mainstream media? Or do you suppose they're just disinterested in the news? And then part of this goes to the idea of, we've got this explosive headline in the New York Times, and it might just be fear-mongering. Are people becoming aware of that? Is that driving them to places like CorbettReport.com?
I certainly hope so, and I think the numbers are bearing that out. In fact, we can answer one of your questions there quite directly. People are losing trust in the media. There was a Gallup poll that just came out last week that showed that the overall trust of the American public in the mainstream media, in newspaper and television, has fallen to its record low. 40% of people say they trust those types of media organizations. So it is, I think, honestly, I think that's a great thing. I think it's a sign that people are tuning out the disinformation that they're hearing. They are tuning out the warmongers and the propaganda meisters and the fearmongers. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're tuning in the Corbett Report, but I can attest on my side.
No, but there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of publications that offer an alternative view of the news.
Absolutely.
Something other than mainstream. No,
I certainly
one of them. And
I see that from my perspective. I can say that from what I can see in my little corner of the internet, the interest in alternative news is absolutely growing, is exploding. This isn't a new phenomenon. This has been taking place for years and years. I think it's gathering steam now. And I don't think that there's a way that this will go back towards people clamoring for the, you know, the New York Times or whatever to tell them the daily news. I think we've gone beyond that paradigm. It's only a question of what will replace it and how it will be replaced. And we're starting to do that piece by piece. Little alternative outlets like yours and mine are doing that. But obviously, it's still a work in progress, and we'll have to see how this ultimately gets done. But I envision a world in which there are no big agencies that are collecting and dispersing information. I think we're going to have a lot of people basically reporting for themselves on the ground.
I agree with you, but it raises a question of who can we trust, because they're, just as the mainstream media is perhaps shown to be unreliable and intentionally misleading us, there's a bunch of other people out on the internet that are completely, they're also unreliable and misleading us by intent or by accident. And maybe we'll talk about that when we return in a moment to financial survival. I'm Alfred Adask here with our guest, James Corbett from CorbettReport.com. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adask here on Financial Survival. I'm here with my guest, James Corbett from CorbettReport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. We're talking about mainstream media, and it appears that the internet is pretty much wiping out, certainly diminishing the power of the former mainstream media. I can remember, I'm not sure if you're old enough to remember Walter Cronkite or not, but I remember him. And, you know, if Uncle Cronkite, Walter, if he said something was true, everyone trusted him, right? He just had that persona, and he was trusted by all, and therefore he commanded enormous respect, and people believed what he had to say. Today, when we look at the mainstream media, I don't get that same feeling of trust. I don't think any of the commentators on mainstream media can generate that feeling of trust. And sometimes it's an exaggeration, perhaps, but they seem a little bit more like carnival barkers. So the question is, how important is trust in any media, whether the media is mainstream or it's alternative? How important is trust, and how do the people know who they can trust?
Well, trust is paramount, but the question is, for what? And I think trust is important for people who are trying to push an agenda. Trust us. Go along with it. It is not important for people who are seeking truth. And that's an important distinction to make. In fact, you bring up probably the best example of this, Walter Cronkite, the man who told you the way the world was and everyone believed it.
And that's the way it is.
Yeah, exactly. Except for the fact that he, unbeknownst to anyone in his viewing audience, I'm sure, at the time in which his career was at full bloom, he was a member of course, the Bohemian Grove Society, which, of course, meets in the redwoods of California every year to worship a 40-foot stone owl and do other weird mock human sacrifices and things of that sort with, you know, presidents and Henry Kissinger and people of that ilk, which again is just bizarre. But he was also, of course, a member of the World Federalist Society and a proponent of world government. And in fact, he gave a famous speech at, the World Federalist Society, I believe, was presenting him with a World Globalism Award or something of that nature, and a proceeding at which was presided over telephonically by Hillary Clinton. So that's the kind of circles that he was running in at that time, obviously after he'd retired from his main broadcasting career. And he gave a speech in which he said something to the effect of, this isn't an exact quote, but he said something to the effect of, some people say that world government is the work of the devil. And he said, well, if that's the case, then join me here at the right hand of Satan. And everyone laughs, ha ha ha, because it's so funny. But no, he was a committed world federalist and a proponent of world government. Of course, something that you were not supposed to know when he was supposed to be the objective anchor that everyone could trust. But it does raise the question of, well, to what extent does that influence and shape and choose what ultimately gets broadcast and how it gets broadcast and what kinds of questions get asked and what questions don't get asked and to whom and by whom, which I think goes to the very heart of the question. Well, what is the trust then? Where was this trust? What was it based on? Was it based on just people like the way he looked and talked and, oh, he sounds like my grandpa, so I'll believe him? If so, then that's obviously misplaced trust, and it isn't, it's actually dangerous, because in the service of an ideology like globalism, a global government, it can be used to steer a public in a direction they're not even necessarily thinking about. And so that, to me, is the fundamental problem of this old paradigm of media, where you have to have a reporter you can trust, and you have to have objective news reporting from objective reporters who are trying to tell you both sides of the story, as if there is ever such thing as objectivity, as if there is ever such thing as a reporter who's above the fray, as if even choosing what subjects to cover and what subjects not to cover is not in and of itself an expression of subjectivity. So I think we've really bust out of that paradigm, and we are heading towards something different, something where people are coming to sources of information that they know to be biased in some way. People who are completely for global government or completely against global government, people who believe in global warming or people who don't believe in global warming, people who support 9/11 truth or people who don't support 9/11, etc., etc. There is more of a factionalization of news sources. And I see that as a healthy thing, because at the very least, I would prefer the sources of information that I go to have their biases on their sleeves rather than to have them up their sleeves, secretly dictating an agenda that I may or may not be dimly aware of. And in the end, I think this is a good thing. I think we are growing past that need to have some sort of, you know, parental figure tell us the way the world is, and moving towards a state in which we realize that no one's going to tell you the way the world is unless they have an agenda. So you might as well be aware of that agenda and consciously piecing that into your worldview.
All right. Well, what is the agenda for the Corbett Report?
Well, ultimately, human freedom, I would say, is my ultimate end point. Obviously, that means different things to different people. And to me, it means the ability to construct a world in which people get to interact voluntarily in ways that they want, mm-hmm. with people that they want, so long as that they're not harming others. And that's the idea of liberty that I'm trying to propound and trying to move toward, and it's something that I advocate. And when I see that being violated, that's something that that obviously motivates me to speak out against it. So I certainly do have a journalistic stand, and I certainly, for example, since the first episode of my podcast, I've been an advocate of 9/11 truth. I have talked very openly about my opposition to genetic modification all sorts of different issues. I mean, we could go through the list. Obviously, I'm anti-war and things of that nature. But again, I don't hide any of these biases, but I present information, I present facts, and I always, always, always link to the source documents that I talk about, because I think that that's the real service to the readers, is to allow them to see here's the trail of cookie crumbs that I used to construct this picture that you just saw. You go and take a look at each cookie crumb and you put it together the way you want. And I think that's the most honest that we can be and the most that we can expect from a media outlet in this day and age when we all do have equal access to the underlying information. I can understand an old paradigm where you had to go to a you had to turn on the TV to see something that was reported by someone in New York who was relying on reporting that was done by people all around the world that you couldn't possibly have access to. But here we are in the internet age. We have access to this information ourselves. The only thing the media organization can do is to bring that together into a narrative form that makes sense to people. And when you do that, you are obviously doing it in the service of a narrative that's part of an agenda.
Let's move on to China a little bit. They have had the weakest industrial output expansion since the global financial crisis. There are reports the Chinese economy is slowing down. Is this much ado about nothing? Is this significant, likely to get more significant? What's happening in China?
Well, China's economic trajectory certainly is towards slowdown. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And it's been that way for several years now. Certainly when we look at sort of productive capacity, there's obviously ups and downs along the way. But overall, I would say the trend is down. And there are a lot of reasons for that. Of course, slowdown in the global economy over the last several years being the primary one. So I don't think it's surprising to see any of these particular types of stories crop up. It's just a question of what does this ultimately mean? And it does have some interesting implications. I mean, obviously, we've seen the explosion, I don't even know what to call it, of the Chinese economy over the past couple of decades that has utterly transformed Chinese society. And I think the question is, has this created the expectation of that continuing prosperity? Not just prosperity, but the continuing acceleration, the continuing expansion of the economy. And if so, then perhaps the Chinese economy is addicted to expansion, which is, of course, always a dangerous place to be in. And the last several years of expansion has only been fueled by the opening of the credit spigot and all of the flowing of this funny money from the Bank of China, which has certainly allowed a lot of construction to take place. But again, if this slowdown ultimately means that that people's expectations have been set too high and there's going to be a lot of crying and people basically trying to collect their chips and cash them out, then that could very go very, very wrong very quickly. We'll put it that way, in a type of bubble popping fashion. And that's what a lot of people have been looking for example, in the Chinese real estate market, which has been an increasing driver of the Chinese economy in recent years. I think now accounts for something like 16% of the Chinese GDP. And if we see a significant slowdown in that, what does that mean? Will people start trying to take their money out of the country? There's a lot of existential questions, really, for China going on through this. And I don't think that it's resolved one way or the other at this point, but I don't see any way that they're going to be able to maintain the type of explosive growth that we saw in the last couple of decades.
Does that make them more vulnerable? That's the implication of this. They've had a great decade or two, but has this made them stronger, or has it made them more vulnerable? If something happens and their growth is seen to fail, will the Chinese people accept that failure, or will they riot?
I think when you have nothing and you lose everything, it doesn't mean so much. But when you start to have a taste of success and a taste of what it is to be a developed industrial society, and you have the prospect of losing everything, people will probably be more inclined to fight for that. And we certainly have seen rest of population in China. There continues to be protests and people continue to be energized by stories of governmental corruption and things of that nature. It's, I think, a very delicate balancing act for the Chinese Communist Party that wants to look like, well, we're going to crack down on corruption, but of course not corruption of our cronies. So I think they feed a few wolves to the pack every now and then. It's interesting to watch. I don't have any definitive answer of how this will play out, but I think increasing restiveness in the population is likely from here on out. I think it's much more difficult to rule over with an iron fist a population that is increasingly urbanized and has had some taste of economic success than it would have been to rule over the largely urban peasant society that China was just a couple of generations ago.
Mm-hmm. So they're riding the tiger. What's the chances that we'll see a two-party system emerge in China? They're running a one political party right now. So far as I know, that's all they've got. Is it inevitable that they're going to have to take on a second political party, even if it's controlled and manipulated and whatever? Do you anticipate something along those lines?
I don't say I can anticipate that. Certainly, I don't think that the Chinese Communist Party as it exists today wants that to happen. I think if they were smart, they would do so, and for reasons that I think is all too apparent to most people living in the modern Western democracies, because as Carol Quigley wrote about in his works, this is the way that the system works. You put these two powers that seem to be opposed and are opposed on certain issues, and you make the elections all about those issues, and then you get the people into those two camps, and they fight with each other, and you give them the chance to throw the rascals out at every election, and you basically continue to work towards the same goal that's there behind the scenes. I think that's a very, very effective form of ruling over a seemingly democratic, seemingly free society, and has worked very well in the United States and elsewhere for a very long time. So I think if they were smart, they would eventually transition into that. But obviously, the allure of having basically autocratic power is too much for most people to relinquish, so I'm not sure that would be relinquished without some sort of incident, some sort of Tiananmen-type incident to make that happen. Although we certainly have seen the rise of Islamic terrorism in China's western front, northwestern front there in Xinhua province in recent years with the Uyghur population, and I think that's going to continue to be, and in fact is going to increasingly be something that's going to be a headache for the Beijing government and might be part of their attempt to keep that iron fist, which is to crack down on the Islamic radicals, and oh, by the way, we'll crack down on everyone else as well.
You know, it's sort of, that's a result of 9/11 in this country. In order to crack down on the terrorists, they crack down on the people who just live here and aren't causing any trouble, other than perhaps wondering if the government is up to good or ill. We're out of time, James. I want to thank you again for being on the program. I always enjoy talking to you. I always enjoy hearing what you have to say on these subjects. And once again, you have not run out of answers before I run out of questions.
Maybe next week.
Look forward to talking to you again next Thursday. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank the producer, and all of the audience. Thanks for listening, folks. Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me.